I'm Dennis Howlett. I'm the chairperson of the Civil Society GHG20 Coalition and coordinator of the Make Poverty History campaign. And I want to welcome everyone here today, and especially thank you to the parliamentarians and panelists who've agreed to take part in this discussion. The Conservative Party was also invited to participate, and unfortunately, they haven't named anyone who could represent them here. It is a nonpartisan event, and so we did try to have every party represented. However, we're very pleased that other parties did send senior people to represent them and engage in this discussion. And I'd like to also point out that this is part of the At the Table 2010 campaign. You can see some of the posters, and at the back of the room there are some campaign materials on display. And if you haven't already done so, please visit the atthetable2010.org website and sign on, and you can find all kinds of interesting information and campaign resources and tools. So I'd like to introduce Pablo Heindrich, who is a researcher with the North-South Institute, and he will be moderating this session, and he will introduce the other panelists. So thank you.
Thank you very much for the introduction. Without further ado, I'm going to introduce Mr. Dean Baker, who is the co-director for the Center on, of Economic and Policy Research at Washington, D.C. He's author of several books on the U.S. economy and on the financial system, and with a particularly interesting view on how the governance of the financial and banking system in the United States affects the average inhabitants and citizens of that country, and very much by extension other parts of the world as well. Dr. Baker will be talking to us about the global financial crisis and how that crisis is turning now into a stage of planning or discussion about what reforms will be done, could be done, and will eventually happen or not. So thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to come up here and speak to this group and on this panel. What I want to talk about is I'm going to focus my comments on financial transactions taxes, which is an area I've done a fair bit of work on over the years. And what I want to say first off a little bit about financial transactions taxes in the context of the current crisis. I'm not going to tell you that it would have prevented the crisis. I will say a little bit about how I think it may relate to the crisis, but I wouldn't be so bold as to claim if we'd had taxes in place, it would have prevented the crisis. Secondly, then, I want to talk a bit about the benefits. Why would we want financial transactions taxes lay out the case? And then thirdly, I'm going to talk a little bit about the report from the IMF that came out last week. They had at least a draft report that evaluated financial transactions taxes along with other taxes that are being considered on the financial sector. Okay, well, starting out, in terms of where our crisis came from, I'd say clearly a big part of that story is a bloated financial sector, and specifically, and here I'm being U.S.-centric, but I think some of this applies to a greater or lesser extent elsewhere in the world. We had an economy in the United States that was driven by financial bubbles ever since the mid-90s. So in the United States, we often talk about a virtuous circle in the decades immediately following World War II, where you had productivity growth that was translated fairly broadly into wage gains, which in turn were translated into consumption, which provided a basis for higher demand, increased investment, productivity growth, et cetera. That really breaks down in the 80s. Beginning in the 80s, partly because of policy, and again, this is a big debate to what extent was policy, what extent it was technology. I'm one of those who thinks it was largely policy, particularly weakening the power of unions. But in any case, what isn't in dispute is that it was no longer the case that most workers saw wage gains, that productivity gains were not broadly shared. They went disproportionately to those at the high end of the distribution, the wage distribution, and to some extent redistribution to capital. So we no longer had this virtuous circle. And that created an environment in which there wasn't the same sort of pull towards investment. We had very weak investment in the United States in the late 80s, actually into the early 90s. So we had the economy go on a very different path. And when we began to actually see strong growth again in the late 90s, there was sort of a folk wisdom at the time that I think persists to some extent, probably more among the Democrats than the Republicans, but that was an investment boom. The real story of the late 90s was that was a consumption boom, that what was going on in the late 90s was that we had a huge run-up in the stock market, and that did not, it led to some increase in investment, but there's always been a very weak relationship between the stock market and investment. What it really did was stock wealth created on the order of $10 trillion of bubble wealth, and that led to a huge consumption boom. And it's easy to show that if you look at what was the area of GDP that was expanding in the late 90s, it was consumption, it wasn't investment. And anyhow, this was, I would say, promoted in part by the financial sector. I'll just say they prospered from it, that in the event you had not had such a vibrant, and probably not the best term, but such a bloated financial sector, you may not have seen that sort of bubble. They certainly profited from it. You may have seen more of a pressure to take a different path of growth. So, again, I'm not going to blame the financial sector for that story, but clearly they profited from it. They were certainly benefited enormously. And, again, because you had that path of growth, this bubble-driven growth, it prevented perhaps more pressure from pursuing alternative paths. We had, of course, our bubble collapsed, our stock bubble collapsed in 2000, 2001. We had the recession. We got out of that recession basically with the housing bubble. So we had this pattern of bubble-driven growth ever since the mid-90s. Again, the financial sector was front and center there. They prospered through it, and that obviously laid the basis for the crisis that we saw in 2008 and the downturn, certainly, that we're experiencing in a big way in the United States, but obviously throughout much of the world. Now, had we had a financial transaction tax, would none of this have happened? I don't think you could really say that. I think that would have reduced the size of the financial sector, slowed things down. Would that have prevented this path of growth? I think that would be, you know, kind of a strong claim. I think it certainly would have been a step in the right direction, but would that by itself, absent a lot of other moves, a lot of regulatory moves, would that have prevented this pattern of growth? I don't feel with any confidence I could say that. So I would simply say that, you know, the bubble-driven growth of the late 90s and the last decade was clearly unsustainable. It created the basis for the crisis that we're experiencing now. Had you had a smaller financial sector, more contained financial sector, you might have been able to prevent that. By itself, financial transaction tax probably would not have done that, although, again, as I would say, it certainly would have helped. Now, more generally, what would I say the arguments are for tax? Well, four things. First and foremost, obviously, money. You could raise an awful lot of money, and I would say that with plausible tax rates, you could raise as much as 1% of GDP through a financial transactions tax. Secondly, reducing the trading volume, the volume of trading in the financial sector, which I consider very much an end in itself. It makes the sector, the industry, more efficient. I'll come back to that. Thirdly, preventing short-term speculation, almost by definition. You're making that more costly. I mean, you're making any trading more costly, but it matters much more if you trade short-term than if you trade long-term. And lastly, just the flip side of that, if you make short-term speculation more costly, in principle, we should be giving a greater incentive towards long-term investment, which is, in principle, what we would want the financial sector to be focused on. Okay, well, going through those one by one, the amount of money that could be raised, again, it's simple enough to do the calculations. I and many others have done calculations, and naturally we recognize there'll be large reductions in trading volume. But in the case of the United States, where I've done most of this, but it's easy enough to apply it to the rest of the world, if you assume somewhere between 50 to 70% reductions in trading volume, you still would collect an amount of revenue that's somewhere in the neighborhood of 1% of GDP. Our financial sector has become so bloated that the volume of transactions exceeds GDP manyfold. And even if, you know, again, even assuming large reductions in trading volume, which is to a large extent the point, of course, of the tax, you still end up with very substantial amounts of revenue. And this really isn't something that should be that heavily debated. I mean, where we put the deficit, you know, where exactly we end up with the exact number might be debated. But the fact you could get large amounts of revenue this way isn't really a debatable proposition because it has been done. England, the UK, has in place a transactions tax. I've actually been trying to find out how far back it goes. I saw a reference to 1694. Now, I'm not sure it's been continuous since then, but they've had a tax in place for many, many decades. They lowered it in the mid-80s to half of 1% on a stock trade. It used to be 1%. But they still collect an amount equal to roughly 0.3% of GDP, and that's just taxing stock trades. So they're not taxing trades of bonds, options, futures, any other derivative instruments. And I should also say, I don't think it's a secret that the UK hasn't been that anxious to enforce it. So insofar as people have found ways to evade it or avoid it, the government has not been as vigilant as it could be in trying to enforce it. And they still get an amount of revenue equal to about 0.3% of GDP. So that's a fairly substantial amount of revenue from a tax that's fairly narrowly applied. As another example, Japan, until the early 90s, had a broad range of financial transactions taxes on stocks, options, futures, most trades, not all, but most trades. And they raised an amount that was equal to about 0.8% of GDP. They got about 4% of their government revenue through the tax. So the idea that this is somehow, we can't get a lot of money this way, clearly we can. Whether it's desirable or not, we could argue. But the fact that we could raise substantial amounts of revenue through these sorts of taxes, clearly it's the case. Okay, a second point, reducing trading volume. I consider this important because, again, just thinking why do we have the financial industry, and not making value judgments here, just, what does it do for the economy? Well, the whole point is it takes money from people who want to save and transfer it to those who want to invest, to borrow for a home or education, whatever it might be. That's its purpose. And in principle, you want it to be as small as possible. It's an intermediate good. I mean, that's the point. And the analogy I often make, it's like the trucking industry. And what's happened, this trucking industry has quintupled relative to the size of the economy. So if you look back to the 70s, and I'm sorry, I'm referring to the U.S., not Canada, but I suspect something comparable here, if not the exact same magnitudes. In the United States in the 70s, the financial sector was equal to about 0.5% of private sector GDP. More recently, it's more than 2.5% of private sector GDP. So we've had a quintuple relative to the size of GDP, and the obvious question is, well, what are we getting for that? Do we think that capital is somehow allocated better, today, 2010, 2007, during the housing bubble? Was it somehow better allocated than it had been back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s? Are we more secure in our savings? What are we getting for that, for this huge growth in that sector? And I think you'd be hard-pressed to identify what exactly you're getting for that. So in that context, if you could reduce the size of the sector, reduce the volume of trading without impeding its ability to function, its ability to transfer money from savers to those who want to invest, to those who want to borrow, that's a pure gain for the economy. So if we could snap our fingers and reduce the size of the trucking sector by 50% and still get all the goods from point A to point B at the same time, why wouldn't we do that? So if through a financial transactions tax we could reduce the resources used by the financial sector, to my mind that's a pure gain. And obviously I should also point out, and again this is U.S. story, but I'm sure at least to some extent a Canadian story and a story elsewhere, you have a very bloated salary structure, and it doesn't bother me that you might be whittling away some of the high-end incomes. These are rents in my view. So that again is a side benefit. The third motivation, preventing speculation, again, here's just sort of a straight logical point. The return you expect to get on a trade where you're buying at 1 o'clock and selling at 2 o'clock is considerably less than what you might expect to get if you're trading, you're buying something this year and you expect to hold the asset for 5 years or 10 years. A trade that you buy at 1 o'clock and you sell at 2, if you made a 1% profit, that would be very good. On the other hand, if you're taxing that, even a very modest tax will make that a much more risky proposition. You'll be much less likely to do that. So it almost by definition has to reduce a lot of the short-term trading. Now, what does that do for volatility? Well, one of the things that anyone would rightly point out, it will reduce arbitrage as well, because you could have a greater divergence. Let's imagine we know the true price of a product, oil or whatever it might be. We somehow know the true price. Well, you could have a greater divergence from that true price before it becomes profitable to step into that market and arbitrage that away. To my mind, that's a relatively little consequence. I mean, if we have the price of oil vary by, 0.1% more because we have this tax in the market that discourages some arbitrage, I see very low cost to that. I'd be willing to live with that. On the other hand, there's an alternative perspective. There's a literature, Larry Summers is actually one of the leading writers in this. I'd like to pick on him for this because I don't think he'd endorse it today, but he did some very good work on this 2 decades ago. There's this literature, Noise Trader, where you have traders that trade on momentum. They see that the price of oil is going up, therefore they buy oil. They couldn't care less what the fundamentals of the oil market are. They're making a bet that the price of oil rose yesterday, it rose this morning, it's going to rise through the rest of the day, and they're going to dump it before it turns around. and that could lead to divergences from fundamentals. So if you have a lot of noise traders in the market who are looking to trade purely on short-term movements, then that can lead to divergences, can lead to bubbles. And I would argue that at least at certain times you could have that effect. You could weaken that effect, I should say, by raising the cost of these transactions. You're making it more costly to engage in this sort of noise trading. You're making a higher risk proposition. And at least at times, that may have the effect of reducing volatility in markets. And again, it's the sort of volatility that I worry about. I care less that oil, you know, went up 0.5% today and it's going to go down 0.5% tomorrow when actually nothing happened in the world, than the case where we have oil go up 30% or 40% and then it collapses. So is this going to prevent all bubbles? No. Might it prevent some bubbles? I would say it might. Won't make a strong argument that way, but it at least might. The last point, again, just the flip side of that, if you make short-term speculation less profitable, we get people to focus on what, in my view, we want them to focus on. What do the fundamentals tell us? Where's a good place to invest for the long term? To my mind, that has to lead to better outcomes. And again, that's just definitional. You've taken some of the profits out of short-term investing. Where are you going to get your profits? It has to be by long term. Okay, well, just quickly, the IMF report came out last week, and they were asked to look at this. Obviously, many governments have expressed interest in financial transactions tax, and that was the reason why the IMF looked into it. And they made several, to my mind, interesting points. First off, one of the disputes, I think it was sort of a silly dispute, but one of the disputes was whether it was even feasible. And the report said quite ambiguously that it was. I mean, I thought it was a silly dispute because you have the UK there collecting a lot of money. So obviously it seems to me it's feasible, you know, unless they're mismeasuring what the revenue they collect in the UK. So it seemed to me pretty evident it was feasible, but, you know, it's good to have the IMF in agreement on that. They raised some downsides to it. They said that it would raise the cost of capital, and they cited some studies that have shown estimates anywhere between 10 basis points and 150 basis points. And the other point they said is that it will be somewhat indiscriminate, that many of the trades you're taxing, you probably don't want to tax. These are both valid points that will raise the cost of capital. Obviously, it will to some extent. There's a big range. If you say 10 basis points, that's probably pretty invisible for most purposes. 150 is certainly more visible. The other point I would say about that is that that's a assumption taking the tax in isolation, just taking the direct effect. The indirect effect, of course, is that you're reducing budget deficits, other things equal. I mean, we have to ask what we use the money for, but if you just the immediate response, you're raising more revenue, you reduce the budget deficit, that would lower the cost of capital. So if you take a full analysis, it's not clear what direction it takes the cost of capital. If we use some of it for reducing budget deficits, we use some of it for other purposes, it could leave the cost of capital pretty much unaffected, but there's no a priori reason to assume it'll lead to a large increase in the cost of capital. In terms of the transactions, again, obviously you will be taxing some transactions that you would rather not. I mean, I don't particularly want to make it more expensive for someone to take out a mortgage on their home. I don't think that's something we really want to do particularly, but it would make that at least to some extent more expensive. Now, how you structure it will determine how much impact it has, but almost certainly, you know, if you say what's the direction of change there, it almost certainly has to be positive. The other side, though, they came up with this idea of a financial activities tax, essentially a value-added tax on the financial sector, which is intended to accomplish many the same purposes as a financial transactions tax. So the point here is, again, it could raise a lot of money. I think they were talking about rates on the order of 15 or 20%. I probably would put it about twice that level, but regardless, I mean, the point's the same. It could raise a substantial amount of money. And secondly, the idea is that we reduce the volume of trading in the financial sector with the idea that there's rents there that we want to eliminate or at least reduce. I think it's an interesting proposal. I think the points, though, we just have to ask when you look at that and compare the financial transactions taxes, you know, which is doing better in terms of, you know, taxing what you want to tax and not taxing the aspects of the financial sector that you think are good. They made a point of saying the financial transactions tax would increase the cost of capital. Certainly, their financial activities tax would also increase the cost of capital. So what's the relative impact? Well, you'd have to boil that down, look at the exact specifics of the structure. But a priori, there's no basis for saying that one will raise the cost of capital more than the other. So I don't know that that gives you a reason to decide one's good or one's bad. The second point, again, just as with the financial transactions tax, a financial activities tax would also tax transactions that we don't particularly want to tax. So again, financial activities tax will make it more expensive for someone to take out a mortgage or a student loan. So, you know, what I would just say about this is that it's an interesting proposal. I'm very glad to see that the IMF is thinking along these lines in the sense they're saying, you know, can we raise money from the financial sector? Can we reduce the volume of trading, volume of rents in the financial sector? It's very good that they're thinking along these lines. I'm still inclined to think that the transactions tax is probably a better route to go, simply because I think by its nature, you will more closely target the sort of transactions you do want to reduce or eliminate. You will more closely target the sort of short-term trading. But, you know, that's not, it's something I think we have to look at the evidence, you know, sit down and try and parse these out more closely, look at specifics and see which comes out better. But I think the basic point, I hope we're moving towards agreement on this, is that we want to have more taxes coming from the financial sector. We want to reduce the volume of trading, volume of activity, and I think that's a very positive direction. So I'll just conclude with that, and, you know, I hope, I look forward to a good discussion.
Thank you very much, Dean. Well, I know that some of the members of our panel are pressed by time. They need to leave. So I'm going to be very brief in the introductions. I begin with John McCallum. Thank you for coming. John McCallum is a member of parliament for the Liberal Party. And he has long experience as a professor of economics and then working also in the banking sector. And before going into politics, we also have Mr. Daniel Pellet, who is from the Bloc Québécois, from Quebec, and he has also worked in economics at the Société Générale de Financement, and he has worked quite a bit looking at the financing of political parties in Canada. And we have also Sir Paul Dewar, who is a representative for the New Democratic Party for Ottawa, and also has a background in political science and economics. And he has worked at the Humanity Fund, among other things, helping fund donations projects in developing countries. So if we are a little bit strict with the time, maybe we can have some 8 to 10 minutes for each one. Of you, if you could begin with Mr. McCallum, is that all right? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Pleasure for me to be here. I always like to have a conservative on the panel, too, because it makes me look more progressive. But imagine a conservative. And I think I'll talk to you mainly as an economist.
One underneath you.
Yeah. Okay, I could give a kick, can I, from here? I'm not convinced really as an economist of the merits of this transactions tax. I'm open to it, but I'll just say that in advance. I think it's useful to look at Canada's experience in the current recession. And it is clear that we have done better than most. Our deficit's around 3.5% of GDP. US and UK are over 10%. Our banks didn't take any taxpayers' money and continued lending, unlike other banks in other countries. Why? Well, I think in terms of the banking system, we retained, I might say as a politician, I wouldn't give any credit to the Conservatives on either of these points, but it is true that we retained a considerable regulation of our banking system at a time when the UK and the US were going into a deregulation, and we did not. And at the same time, the government said no to proposed bank mergers. And I'm happy to do a little bit of a mea culpa here, because 10 years ago I was working for Royal Bank and arguing in favor of a bank merger with Bank of Montreal. And I remember well the mentality of the day, which was that we were going to grow up, go international, kick butt, and become like Citibank. And you saw what happened to Citibank. So now with hindsight, I think the government of Jean Chrétien was absolutely right to say no. So our banking system weathered the storm, didn't require a penny of taxpayers' money. And at the same time, we had run surpluses, so the Conservatives inherited a big surplus when they came to power, which mitigated the impact on the deficit of the recession. So I think if you want to have a new tax on banks, the first question is, what's the motive? If the motive is to tax banks so that they pay back the money that they receive from the taxpayers, then that doesn't apply in Canada because they didn't receive any. If the motive is to tax banks to create a fund with which to deal with future bailouts, then I would argue it's better to force banks to have a higher capital ratio, in effect create their own funds against adverse events in the future. And if it's their own fund, they will be more careful than if it's the public fund. So I don't really go for that argument terribly. If the motive is to raise money, and I certainly agree one can raise lots of money, to finance development or environment, then I'm a whole lot more sympathetic. Because at a personal level, I spent Easter week in Nairobi, and I visited the slums of Nairobi. I've never in my life, having led a relatively protected life, sheltered, seen anything like that, and attended a microfinance conference where Muhammad Yunus, who won the Nobel Prize, was there, and I met lots of people and became convinced microcredit was successful so and should be supported more. And I criticized the Conservatives for freezing our own aid budget once this year is over, even though they're simultaneously talking about major initiatives for Haiti, for maternal health, for Afghanistan. I don't think that adds up. $4.4 billion over 4 years is how much they save from freezing the CETA budget, which is about one quarter of the total deficit reduction. So one quarter of the total planned deficit reduction is, if you will, on the backs of the poorest people of the world. So I'm in favor of more money for development, but I'm not convinced that this is necessarily the best way to raise that money. But the IMF has been sent back to the drawing table to come up with new proposals, and I certainly think one should have an open mind, especially Canada, as chair of the G20. We should have a lively discussion and a decision, but I don't know what the IMF will come up with. So what would I think should be done to make the banking system more stable? Well, I think, I don't want to sound like a praiser of my own country, but I think we have shown that our system has functioned relatively well compared with most other countries. So I think one recommendation would be we continue with fairly robust regulation, that we have enforce capital reserves, which are big enough to justify the risk of the activities that the banks are carrying out, and also to create some sort of a buffer for future shocks. I think even though the banks haven't taken taxpayers' money, I think the regulator should regulate the form of bank remuneration. I don't think that remuneration should be such as to encourage traders to take big short-term risks for short-term gain. I think that the structure of remuneration is important and should come under the purview of the regulator. And I think it's important to find a mechanism to get rid of this too-big-to-fail problem. And that is one thing that people are working on, and it's very complicated. But if a bank is seen to be too big to fail, as happened in the last crisis, then that's a problem for the system as a whole, and I think it needs attention. But I guess, in terms of this financial transactions tax, I don't quite understand why it's so advantageous to reduce the volume of trading. If I look at the bubbles we've had in the past, I see them as being driven primarily by human nature, a cycle of greed and fear, that the high-tech bubble, there was greed, if you will, and then it crashed and there was fear. And I don't see that the absence of a transactions tax had anything much to do with either the high-tech bubble or the housing bubble. I think the conventional wisdom is the housing bubble was, in the U.S., was driven primarily by very expansionary monetary policy. And as Dean said himself, I think he's not arguing that the housing bubble was driven by the lack of a transactions tax, or that such a transactions tax would have stopped it. So I think I'm coming to the end of my time, but to sum up, I think it is very important for the world to come up with more funding for development, the Millennium Development Goals, etc. I'm not convinced that this kind of a tax is the best way to do it. It's not at all clear anyway that those who advocate such a tax would indeed use it for that purpose. Some seem to suggest it could be used simply to reduce government deficits or to create a fund to mitigate future financial crises. It's not clear to me that there's any central agreement or consensus on what that money would be used for. So I'm certainly open to look at proposals that the IMF may come up with, but given the performance of our own financial sector, and given what I've just said about not understanding really why a tax on financial transactions would do much to help the economy other than generate billions of dollars of revenue, I guess at the moment I remain somewhat skeptical about such a tax, but certainly open to having it vigorously discussed at the G20 meetings. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll turn to
Yann again. Oui. Voilà. Moi, je suis, pour celles et ceux qui ne le savent pas, je suis le plus jeune député à la Chambre des communes en tant qu'ancienneté. Je suis très bien à gauche de M. McCollum. Très, très bien. D'autant plus que le ministre des Finances, M. McCollum et moi, nous avons un point en commun. Nous sommes tous nés à Montréal. Moi, j'y suis resté.
Et Mulcair aussi.
Alors, donc, ce qui est important aussi, c'est de voir d'où on vient. On l'a signalé un peu. Et la majeure partie de mon expérience professionnelle, ça a été dans l'entreprise privée, soit comme CFO ou soit comme vice-président exécutif au niveau des investissements. J'étais à la Caisse de dépôt, par exemple, au début des années 90, quand la Caisse de dépôt avait de très bons rendements, by the way. Et si j'avais à établir, si on avait un tableau, si on avait à établir des mots pour une conférence comme ça, je commencerais par de la confiance jusqu'à la panique et d'essayer de trouver entre les deux où est-ce que nous sommes et où on veut aller et où on ne veut pas aller. Alors, bien sûr, on n'est pas dans la confiance, on n'est plus dans la panique, du moins pas pour l'instant. Donc, on est quelque part entre de la méfiance ou de l'inquiétude pour arriver à un sentiment neutre et d'oser espérer d'aller à la confiance. Comme mise en contexte, on se demandait il y a un certain nombre d'années que il y avait le fameux concept « too big to fail ». En mars 2008, par exemple, Bear Stearns a été sauvé par le gouvernement américain en disant « bon ben, il faut absolument faire ça ». Jusqu'au 15 septembre, il y a eu le 11 septembre de 2000, mais le 15 septembre, c'est 2009, excusez-moi, c'était donc Lehman Brothers. Le fait que le gouvernement américain laisse aller Lehman Brothers, c'est dans le fond un immense signal que l'on peut retirer une garantie implicite soit du gouvernement américain auprès de ses banques. Il y a eu donc une rupture de la confiance. Le mot supérieur de la confiance, il y a eu cette rupture-là. Et c'était pas la première fois, mais c'était peut-être la première fois de façon aussi intense. On se rappelle qu'à un moment donné, la ville de New York était près de la faillite. Et c'est le gouvernement qui, sans aucune garantie officielle, l'a sauvé. Même chose avec Chrysler et Jimmy Carter. Et pourquoi pas le cas de la Grèce aujourd'hui? J'y reviendrai à la fin de ce court exposé. Et dans le fond, en théorie, les leçons, c'est de se dire, est-ce que, oui, il y a eu des interventions massives des banques centrales et des États, l'objectif premier, c'était d'enrayer la panique. Et d'enrayer la panique, il faut le faire à court terme. Il faut le faire vite, il faut essayer d'arrêter cette panique-là, puis à tout le mieux de monter à la méfiance, d'aller à l'inquiétude et de remonter au sentiment de neutralité. Mais la panique, c'est très court terme. On ne vient pas à long terme en panique. On panique, bang! Mais de ressortir de la panique, ça, c'est long. Donc, il faut beaucoup de psychologie, il faut beaucoup de gestes immédiats. Hein. Quand le feu est pris dans une maison, on n'appelle pas le décorateur pour lorsque la maison sera sauvée. On appelle les pompiers. Mais c'est après que là, on va voir si on démolit et on recommence. Il faut donc stabiliser le patient, il faut assainir. Et il faut avoir des résultats de court terme, ensuite de moyen terme. Donc, ce qu'il faut, c'est du temps et de voir d'où ça vient, cette crise-là. Bien sûr, au Canada, bon, on dit bien que le Canada s'est bien tiré. Est-ce que c'est structurellement ou conjoncturellement? C'est évident que l'an passé, en Colombie-Britannique, il n'y avait pas beaucoup de chômage quand on a les Jeux olympiques. Ce que l'on doit voir là maintenant, c'est que la crise financière a amené la crise économique, ou a doublé, ou a triplé, ou a fait que la crise économique soit devenue, en termes de structurel. C'était dans sa structure, dans son système même. Le système financier a montré que il y avait un problème, il fallait l'assainir, et ensuite de réguler. Et la régulation, il faut à la fois que ce soit plus, il faut que ce soit mieux, et donc ça pose une grande question, c'est que le système financier au Canada, par exemple, il y a beaucoup d'auto-réglementation. Les commissions de valeurs mobilières, les courtiers en valeurs mobilières sont auto-réglementés. Est-ce qu'il faut continuer à aller vers là? Donc, il y a eu des gestes d'éclat. Hein, quand je parle qu'il faut régler la panique, il faut réagir vite. Il y a eu des gestes d'éclat, par exemple, à Pittsburgh, où M. Sarkozy a dénoncé les paradis fiscaux, a lutté contre les fonds spéculatifs. Mais qu'est-ce qu'on fait? Quels sont les gestes profonds maintenant qu'il faut faire? Ces gestes-là ne sont pas faits, ne sont pas encore faits. Là, on est peut-être dans une instabilité financière. Peut-être dans une instabilité monétaire. On ne sauve pas la Grèce à cause de la Grèce. On sauve la Grèce à cause du système monétaire de l'euro. Le système euro ne peut pas se payer une faillite de la Grèce. Ça aurait pu être n'importe quel autre pays. Et les Allemands l'ont très bien compris, puisque ce sont eux qui vont payer le plus cher. Les Allemands, oui, ils vont casser un jour. Bon, on dit qu'il faut payer 8,5 milliards en Grèce pour le 19 mai. Bon, ben, pourquoi régler maintenant? Aujourd'hui, encore dans les dépêches, on disait « Ah, c'est pas encore réglé ». Mais non. Non, ça va se régler vers le 15-16 mai. Parce qu'on est comme ça dans la vie. On va essayer de faire en sorte que les leçons portent. Le monde a mobilisé d'énormes capitaux. On n'a pas idée du nombre de capital qui a circulé depuis 2 ans. Et je vous défie, il faudrait faire une étude là-dessus, de dire, prenons tous les milliards, les zilliards qui sont promenés dans le système capitaliste mondial, et si on l'avait utilisé pour enlever la pauvreté à travers le monde, on aurait réussi. On n'aurait plus de pauvreté maintenant dans le monde si on avait pris tous les milliards et les zilliards que le système bancaire et le système financier ont pompé, puis on l'avait mis ailleurs. Ma crainte, et je terminerai là-dessus, c'est que il y a de l'avidité. Il y a plein de gens qui ont été impunis. Il y a beaucoup d'impunité là-dedans. Il y a beaucoup d'irresponsables. On n'a pas tué personne, mais donc il y a des gens qui ont eu, oui, moins de bonus, moins de bonis, les salaires ont peut-être gelé, mais le problème qu'on a, c'est est-ce qu'on va tout simplement s'excuser et pour mieux recommencer? Et ça, à mon avis, ça serait une très, très grave erreur que de juste s'excuser, comme par exemple la semaine dernière, General Motors a remboursé le gouvernement du Canada 5 ans d'avance en disant « Thank you very much, on paye avec l'intérêt, merci, au revoir. » Et ils vont recommencer, ces gars-là. Donc, les banques, c'est, à mon avis, la crainte. Bon, la poursuite actuelle contre Goldman Sachs, peut-être nous amène à se dire il y aura des changements importants dans le système financier mondial. Donc, à mon avis, il faut une régulation mondiale, il faut probablement une application locale, mais une régulation mondiale. Et bon, oui, la taxe sur les transactions financières, ça peut être une façon de voir les choses, mais encore une fois, il ne faut pas juste dire on va changer une porte à battant par une porte accordéon. Il faut changer peut-être le système de porte. Et moi, je demeure inquiet en me disant, s'il y a eu les grandes faillites, s'il y a la Grèce qui nous pend au bout du nez, s'il y a d'autres circonstances, est-ce qu'on aura appris de la crise qui vient d'arriver? Et moi, j'espère, en tout cas, qu'ici, à Ottawa, en comité parlementaire, on pourra faire l'analyse. La semaine dernière, j'ai déposé au comité permanent des finances, sur lequel M. McCullen siège, et des gens du Parti conservateur, une motion pour qu'on puisse étudier fondamentalement la taxe Tobin ou la taxe, une taxe de cette nature, et de prendre le temps de l'étudier. Et je suis content de savoir que John va m'appuyer. Merci beaucoup, et on prendra des questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Daniel Pellet. And now we're going to turn to Mr. Paul Dewar. And please, thank you.
Merci bien. It's I have to applaud John because it's not the first time I've heard him state his mea culpa. And I think politicians don't do that often, so I think he should be given some credit for that. And I say that because it is fascinating to watch this government go on the world stage and brag about how strong our financial institutions are because of our strong regulatory system and the fact that our banks resisted the urge to merge. History will treat this perhaps a little differently because people are going to take a look at what this government said about financial institutions a couple years ago and the need to deregulate to allow mergers. And when that happens, this government will be, having to be accountable for where they would have taken us if they had been in government at the time. And many of us remember well the debates in this country around bank mergers and deregulation. And I think it's important to state that because right now, what the Conservatives are doing, and we just saw it this past weekend, is that when there are ideas put forward to look at global regulation of financial markets, they seem to think, you know, we don't need to do that because everything, I'm okay, Jack, right? I'm fine, we're fine, we don't really need to deal with it. It's you guys over there. Well, it's interesting because it would be like saying that, you know, you can build a wall up and that you're not going to be affected by, you know, floods, etc., and realizing that the water levels are rising, that's actually true, it's not just a metaphor, and that you're going to be protected. And what are you going to do? I guess keep building the walls up, but eventually you're going to have to acknowledge your situation in the world. And that's what is so troubling, I think, with the government, is either they don't have any ideas or they're not willing to entertain ideas. And why that's crucial is, of course, because the fact we have the gavel for the G8 and the G20. And we are the ones who are supposed to be at least, you know, they don't have to agree with the ideas, but at least entertain the ideas that have been put on the table. And that's why I was deeply disturbed over the weekend to hear the response from Flaherty. And something else I have to say is I wasn't really impressed with the reporting on it. I didn't think that the way it was reported really gave an overview of what some of the options were and the importance of actually having a debate around what those options are as we lead up to the G8, G20. I think John, I might agree with you on the idea that let's look at this perhaps as the financial transaction tax or the FAT. I like to say in a fat tax, it's kind of interesting, is something that could be put on the table to say, well, at least for the commitments we made for the Millennium Development Goals, it's not a bad idea. You can raise some revenue. I'd like to, you know, look into that a bit more to say, but would it have dealt with speculation? I have, you know, the one thing that we haven't talked about in this country, we were weathered the storm okay, but don't forget the asset-backed commercial paper. That actually did hit us, and we did respond, and governments had to go in and shore up those dodgy investments. And that's going to happen again at some point. And if we're going to be able to weather the storm again, it's going to be in a global context. And I think if it's not the FTT or if it's not the financial activities tax, then it begs the question, then what is it going to be? Coordinating, you know, economies such that they are going to protect themselves and each other from, as has been mentioned, contagions. You can't just sit back and watch the world go by. You have to have something. So I guess I would say that if it's not this, then what is it going to be? And I think for Canada to not at least put something on the table to say, you know, we don't believe in the FAT or we don't believe in the FTT, I think it's incumbent upon them to put something on the table. Why? Because think of the opportunity cost here. If we're the only ones who aren't willing to get involved here, what is the opportunity cost of that decision? It is that either it won't happen or Canada won't participate, and therefore Canada can't benefit from it. Because make no mistake, if there's money generated here, there's an opportunity for Canada to benefit. And I think if you're looking at the financial transaction tax, for instance, and it's something that will generate money as well as calm some of the kind of transactions we've seen, then I think most Canadians would like to see us do that, and I think our partners would like to see us do that. When we look at what some have said about the proposals put forward, be it on the FTT or the FAT, and I'll cite our government because they seem to be the ones who are the strongest critics, you know, the suggestion that, you know, we're a sovereign country and you know, we can regulate our own and we don't need to do that. It's kind of bizarre in a sense because it's suggesting that they're not acknowledging we're in a globalized situation environment, as if you could, you know, isolate yourself. And their idea is that, you know, just take care of your own backyard. Well, what we know is that the loopholes that exist aren't just loopholes that are situated in Canada. They're loopholes that are situated all around the world. What happens is when you have these loopholes, then you see where capital can be parked and speculative profits can be parked, these tax havens. I think if you look at getting involved in something like an FTT or perhaps the FAT, what it will cause is not just the looking at how financial markets behave and you generate revenues, but also where the money will go. I think you'll have a much more attention paid. Why? Because you're instituting something that is coordinated. And so these, you know, we've seen it. We've seen the tax havens. We've seen speculative profits that are made. Are, you know, they find tax havens. I think if you have the G8 and beyond the G8 to coordinate something like FTT or FAT, I think you would also be able to situate where these profits were going and are going and regulate them. I mean, you know, let's not be scared of that. If we're going to get into this, there's nothing wrong with regulating speculation. I think that's a good thing. We want to have solid investments. I think that's already been mentioned. Finally, I think if we're entertaining ideas around transaction tax or financial activity taxes, I think it is a fair thing to say that in this country, we want to make sure that the money finds its place to the right place. And I think most people certainly want to see us pick up the pace on our commitments to the Millennium Development Goals. And I say that because one thing that I don't think is debated enough or acknowledged enough is this notion that somehow we've been giving to the South. I mean, there's been enough studies done to show that the money has been going the other way. And when you actually look at the kind of because of either bizarre loan schemes or the amounts of interest that have been taken from developing countries, that it's time we actually said, you know what, it, not only is the Millennium Development Goals something we have to sign on to, but it's because of the recent past in which capital was actually flowing the wrong way. And you look at the south-north flow of capital, I think it's incumbent upon us not just to say, oh, that we want to reach our Millennium Development Goals because they're lofty. It's also to say we need to right a wrong that happened over the last number of years. And the minimum on that is to meet our Millennium Development Goals. One final thing, I don't think it's been mentioned that I think we have to also acknowledge, not just the commitments that John has made about Haiti, about Afghanistan and others, but is that the fast track of Copenhagen, or you might have mentioned it. You know, we're talking $30 billion we signed on to from 2010 to 2012 that we were going to, we haven't told our partners how much money we're going to put into that fund. You know, it doesn't fall from the sky. We have to find a way. I believe it's a credible argument to be making right now to say one of the best ways we can calm the kind of speculation we saw is through some form of financial transaction tax to raise money for our commitments, to stem the flow of money that went from the south to the north, and to get on with dealing with what many say is the most important issue of the day, and that is to fight climate change. If we don't do that, then we'll be probably having this discussion again and saying that instead of whatever the number is that's proposed for an FTT, it will have to be doubled, and I think that would be sad. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Daniel Dewar. Now I will pass it on to Fraser Reliking, who is the head of the Halifax Initiative Coalition, will develop some civil society questions for the members of Parliament and for our keynote speaker. Thank you.
Before I get into the questions, I guess I'll do a little bit of a presentation as well myself. But it picks up a lot, I think, on what's already been said. Mr. McCallum and others have noted how, you know, Canada has got off relatively scot-free in a way because of our sound regulation of the banking system, because of capital requirements and leverage requirements. And, you know, the Conservative government themselves have been using that a lot internationally, just to say, look at the Canadian model. But if we keep on up with this, all of the self-congratulations, as Mr. Dewar has said, you know, we're not looking at opportunities for change that can take place. And just to sort of coin an old phrase, with all the self-congratulations, well, Flaherty will get you nowhere. So I think, yeah, please feel free to. And this is what we've seen a lot with this government, is that there's very little ambition to move forward on issues. And one thing that I think has been common to all of the speeches here is that, you know, we're still, despite Canada doing well, this is still very much a time of crisis for a lot of countries. Just last year, I was at a conference in Barcelona of the European Network on Debt and Development, and there was an individual from Africa who said, everybody keeps on telling me about this crisis, and I just have to ask them which crisis, because we've been living in a crisis for so long. Similarly, at the UN conference last year on the global financial crisis, the president of Ecuador says, again, everybody is telling me that with a crisis comes an opportunity. Well, I'd like an opportunity without a crisis. And I think these are some of the things that we need to be looking forward and pointing to. And in that context, I maybe want to touch on just a few areas from our civil society platform that I think offer an opportunity for countries. And maybe I'd like to hear a little bit more on the reactions from our members of Parliament, because, I mean, among these elements is the financial transactions tax, but there are other elements that I think we need to think about. And the first one is, and I'll frame it initially, the first three points under the idea of plug the leaks, fill the gaps and get on track. By plug the leaks, I mean the fact that the G20 has started to address the issue of tax havens. Global Financial Integrity, a research or an NGO in the United States in Washington, has done a report, has done a lot of work over the past decade looking at the amount of outflows of capital from developing countries. And in their most recent report, they estimate around $1 trillion escapes in terms of illicit financial outflows from developing countries, of which around 65% is through the activities of transnational corporations. Again, Christian Aid, another organization in the UK, has estimated that just through one type of tax evasion, developing countries lose around $160 billion a year in tax revenue, in lost tax revenue. What was the, if we put that in context, in 2008, global aid levels from the OECD were around $120 billion. So this is lost revenue just through the activities of transnationals that developing countries can't count on. So we need to plug those leaks. We also need to fill the gaps. This context right now, the financial crisis, is very interesting in that a number of countries, Italy, Ireland, now Canada, are essentially flatlining their aid budgets. CCIC has done some research and estimates that while Canada's percentage of gross national income for aid today is around 0.33%, in 5 years, when we come to the end of the Millennium Development Goals, or at least the 15-year period for trying to realize them, Canada's aid levels will be down at 0.28. We're at the bottom of the pack. So how do we fill those gaps? Well, I think we're a strong believer in this. At the Table campaign has been a strong advocate of this idea of financial transactions tax. A number of people have mentioned the IMF report. I mean, I feel that a lot of the focus has perhaps rightly been placed on measures that need to be put in place to help bail out the banks. You know, some were deemed too big to fail. The IMF has come up with some interesting ideas for trying to raise revenue to help with the bailouts. The Obama administration has pursued a policy. In France and Germany, they're talking about a bank levy. But once we bail out the banks, how about the rest of the world? And I think Bruno Jatin, an economist with the University of Paris, has estimated that between 2012 and 2014, on an annual basis, the world will require around $710 billion a year to pay for the costs of climate change mitigation and adaptation, to help countries realize the Millennium Development Goals, and to cover the costs of deficits and debts that a number of countries are facing today. And Stefan Schulmeister and Dean Baker and others have done a lot of research to look at how much money a financial transaction tax might generate. And I guess if you sort of pick the average, we've been talking about around $650 billion, even with a decline in the market of around 60% that could be generated every year. And I think we shouldn't underestimate the importance of raising that amount of revenue at times when aid budgets are collapsing, when people are unemployed, when countries are suddenly finding that the progress that they made on achieving the MDGs is going down the drain. And we still have this crisis of climate change as well that we need to deal with. How are we going to tackle all of that? And I think we need to look into more sort of innovative ways of funding this money. So we need to help try and fill the gaps. And then lastly, just on this sort of topic, is we need to get back on track. I've already mentioned that the Canadian aid budget is going to flatline next year. How are we going to get back on track to achieving the 0.7 target that we've been talking about since the 1960s? Canada needs to set a timetable. you know, it's for achieving that goal in the next decade. And it's shameful that we're playing host to the G8 and G20. And not only do we have no ambition for moving anything progressive forward, but we even decide to drop our own aid budget. So on those three issues, I'll come back with maybe some more specific questions. But this is where I think this platform is hoping that we might move forward on tax havens, on the financial transactions tax, and on setting a timetable for aid. Another overarching theme that the campaign has picked up, which nobody's mentioned today, but I think is an important one, is just around global governance. The G20 self-proclaimed itself as the new leaders forum, the new premier forum for international economic cooperation. If you look at the BRICS statement, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, you know, what used to maybe be slightly radical countries in some of what they were saying, I find their statements are getting more and more run-of-the-mill. They're sounding more and more like G20 and G8 communiques. As one columnist, I think, in Time magazine said, if you take China out of the BRICS, it just becomes brie, which is this sort of soft cheese. And I think that's very true. Equally, within the G20, there's been a lot of fuss made over the fact that not everyone can agree and that China is raising issues that weren't raised in other fora. I think that's the whole point, is that you have more countries around the table. But still, you know, if we're to accept that the G20 is representative and credible and legitimate as a forum, I think we'd also be wrong placed. Because, for example, just on Africa, South Africa is the sole representative of the entire continent, and I don't think it has any ambitions to be able to represent the continent. It's going to represent its own interests. And so we've developed through various networks a sign-on statement that's at the back, signed on to by 300 organizations, including Oxfam International, ActionAid International, Greenpeace, Third World Network, a number of different groups, that lays out five principles that we think need to guide a truly global leaders forum. That such a forum needs to be more representative, raise the issue of South Africa speaking for the rest of the African continent. It needs to be more inclusive. There's no low-income countries around the table. How can their agendas be on the table if there's no one there to speak to these issues? It needs to be more transparent and accountable. Just as the G8 is moving forward and developing a framework for accountability, the new G20 is the premier forum. It has no precedent whatsoever in terms of transparency and accountability. It has no formal interaction with civil society. How do we remedy that? And on the last two points, it needs to build bridges to the United Nations system and more global membership. Last year, it was a prime example of how the G20 was doing everything in its power to undermine the UN system. How are we going to strengthen multilateralism globally if we're not looking towards strengthening the United Nations? And then finally, and this is hopefully an issue that speaks to many of you on the panel as well, we need to create a voice for civil society and parliamentarians within the G20. At the G8, there's a civil G8 process that allows civil society organizations to interact with the G8, but there's nothing of that sort at the G20. So perhaps if I that was in part to highlight some of the issues on our platform. So if I get to questions, I think for all of the panelists, you know, where does your party sit on the new G20? Are you looking to perhaps some of these principles that might help guide a truly global leaders forum? Do we accept, I realize there's sort of a legacy in the way of the G20 with Paul Martin, but do we want to freeze in history today a forum that needs to solve problems tomorrow? So I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts on that. And maybe also a little bit more, perhaps I'd come back to Mr. McCallum, who who was supportive of the idea of a financial transactions tax if it was for development and environment. Well, you'd be more sympathetic then. You know, we've been focusing on both the amount of revenue it could generate while also talking about its potential for curbulating speculative activity. You know, where do all of the parties sit perhaps on that if it was geared much more specifically to helping countries boost their economies and pay off debts and deficits, helping the world realize the MDGs and pay for climate change? And then maybe just lastly, you know, what could we look to parliamentarians to do to move in particular the FTT forward? And Canada has a particular historical legacy on this in that 11 years ago, Canada was the first parliament around the world to pass a motion in favor of a transaction or a tax on financial transactions.
No.
I'm not sure.
Maybe it's because I said the word tax. Anyway, there's a specific historical legacy. The NDP, I think, tabled the motion. It was supported by the Bloc and also by a number of Liberal MPs, including Paul Martin himself. And what are the opportunities for perhaps renewing some discussions of that past historical legacy?
I would just invite any of the members of the panel to answer the questions that Fraser has been putting on the table. I think Daniel Pellier was first. John, go ahead. Go ahead.
Oui, je voudrais souligner le rôle du parlementaire. C'est justement, par exemple, de venir à des rencontres comme on a ici. Parce que, ça favorise la réflexion. C'est, on réglera pas la crise ici ensemble avant 22 heures ce soir. Donc, on réfléchit et on ne sait jamais. On ne sait jamais parce que moi, je sais que je ne serai jamais ministre des Finances du Canada. John l'espère, Paul en rêve, mais moi je sais que je ne le sais jamais. Mais on peut contribuer, on peut contribuer à cette réflexion-là. Un des points que vous n'avez pas mentionné, mais qui mérite de l'être, c'est généralement les gens vont dire, on s'oppose à une taxe, par exemple, sur les grandes institutions, parce que ce sont les clients qui vont payer pour. Mais bien sûr. Mais c'est évident, il y a toujours un transport d'un fardeau. Mais qui sont les clients? C'est pas le petit commerçant ou la petite famille avec des taux hypothécaires. Ce sont les très gros clients ou les très grands actionnaires qui auront à essuyer un peu cette taxe-là. Un des éléments, et je veux vous prendre au bon là-dessus, c'est que moi, j'ai des problèmes à associer une taxe, le fruit d'une taxe et son utilisation. On est habitué au Canada, au Québec et dans plusieurs pays du monde à avoir ce qu'on appelle un fonds consolidé. On ramasse des taxes, des impôts, des droits, toutes sortes de choses. On met ça dans un pot et on n'associe pas des revenus avec des dépenses. Parce que le danger de ça, c'est que là, on rêve. On rêve beaucoup, on se dit... Une taxe sur les transactions financières pourrait apporter des milliards de dollars, mais méfions-nous. Le jour où il y aura une taxe sur les transactions financières, il y aura dans chacune des grandes banques canadiennes autant de fiscalistes qu'il y en a au ministère des Finances ici à Ottawa pour essayer de trouver les loopholes, pour essayer de trouver les manières de contourner ça. Et l'objectif d'un gouvernement, entre autres, c'est d'imposer des taxes. L'objectif d'un entrepreneur, c'est d'essayer de les éviter. Pas nécessairement de ne pas les payer de façon illégale, mais d'essayer de les éviter. Et les paradis fiscaux, d'ailleurs, c'est une utilisation d'une fiscalité. Moi, comme CFO dans des entreprises privées connues, on a utilisé des paradis fiscaux parce que c'était légal.
Est-ce que c'était légitime? Ça, c'est une autre paire de manches. Mais c'était là. C'était notre objectif. Donc, le jour où on va associer une dépense par rapport à une taxe, et si la taxe ne donnait rien, s'il n'y en avait plus, ou s'il y avait des loopholes terribles ou une façon de ne pas savoir administrer cette taxe-là, là, on se retrouverait du jour au lendemain en disant « Ah, il n'y a rien pour l'environnement, il n'y a rien pour l'aide humanitaire, il n'y a rien. » Associer une taxe à une dépense, c'est déresponsabiliser les gouvernements. Et moi, je suis contre ça. Un gouvernement doit être responsable. Et si jamais John est ministre des Finances, moi, je vais continuer à lui poser des questions. Okay? Et je ne veux pas qu'il me dise « Ah, on avait prévu 500 millions ou 500 milliards pour cette taxe-là, ça ne donne que 200 milliards, donc je ne suis pas capable d'investir là où on avait promis. » Moi, je veux lui dire « Non, non, non. Vous avez des taxes, vous avez des décisions politiques à prendre au niveau de la pauvreté. » Je reviens sur mon histoire de pauvreté, sur l'environnement, sur tel effet, pigé dans le fonds consolidé. Pas nécessairement une taxe. Parce que ça déresponsabiliserait John McCullen. Et je ne veux pas. Je ne veux pas là-dessus. Un mot sur la gouvernance. Et dans le fond, c'est des comportements. Et on a beau dénoncer la Chine, par exemple, dénoncer la Corée du Nord, dénoncer les paradis fiscaux. Allez voir en fin de semaine au site du ministère des Finances du Canada, M. Flaherty a émis 3 communiqués de presse, et les 3 communiqués de presse, c'était « Au nom du Canada, de blablabla, de la Barbade, de Belize, de... » Puis moi, je me disais, ah, « Tiens, regardons ça. Ils parlent au nom de pays à des paradis fiscaux. » Enfin, on les connaît. Alors ça, il y a des questions à poser là-dessus, mais je ne veux pas prendre beaucoup de temps parce que je voulais mettre l'accent sur... N'associez jamais une taxe à son utilisation. C'est deux choses différentes.
Michael?
Mr. Minister of Finance.
Well, you're getting a bit ahead of yourself, but I don't dislike that thought. Let me quickly go through the various points that have been raised. I confess to a little bit of bias in favor of G20, since in a sense it was Paul Martin who invented it. Not for leaders, but for finance ministers. And Harper hated it at the time. And now they're doing it. So it's not perfect. It's far from perfect. But it's far, far better than the G8. And so we take progress one step at a time. I certainly agree that civil society in G20 could be done the way it is for the G8. I don't see any problem with that. But if you're starting to tinker with the numbers to move from G20 to G30 or G40, that's tough. I would rather, I think, see the G20 function a little longer. It hasn't been around much time. So I think to bring in civil society or parliamentarians is a good idea, but let's wait a little while before we try to change the membership, is what I would say. On the 3 points, on tax havens, I think we should do more about tax havens. I don't know if all those billions are credible numbers, but I think that we, as a country and as the world, could do more than we have currently been doing. Now, on the transactions tax and aid, I wrote down 5 points about transactions tax. One, I think people have generally said you need near unanimity of agreement among countries if it's to work, because otherwise people will change their foreign exchange transactions to the countries who are not members. So that in itself is a challenge. Second, the incidence. If it's multiple tens or hundreds of billions, you can't just assume that the incidence is just on the fat cats. I think this has to be studied. Maybe it has been studied. But it would seem to me that any Canadian traveling to the United States for a holiday would be affected, both leaving Canada for the United States, returning. Possibly people acquiring mortgages would be affected, taking out personal loans. So the incidence is an important issue. The third point, the magnitude of the tax. Maybe Dean will explain, but I used to work for a bank, And people used to tell me they'd change radically the way they do business if this tax ever came into being. So you say, even with a 60% reduction of trades, well, maybe it'll be a 90% reduction of trades. Maybe it'll be a 95% reduction of trades. I don't know. But people will react. If there are hundreds of billions of dollars at stake, don't expect everyone to just sit there carrying on business as usual. So I don't know how much money it would raise. Finally, I agree with Danielle. Je suis tout à fait d'accord. On ne veut pas un impôt dédié, a dedicated tax to a specific thing. Money is money. Money is fungible. Finally, I have always believed in the importance of international assistance. Before I get into that, I definitely also agree with Paul that that we should certainly entertain ideas as a country, as the host. I think I said that, but he said it better. Entertain ideas, if not have our own. I think it might be a good idea for Canada, as side of the honest broker, to put some of our own ideas rather than just flailing out against other people's ideas. And this is my final issue, truly final, about foreign assistance. As I said, I've always believed in it, and my recent experience reinforced that. And I'm strongly opposed to the Conservatives' freezing of the budget at $5 billion, because that means over the next 4 years, unless GDP stays absolutely flat or shrinks, our contribution as a percentage of GDP, which is already fairly pathetic, will be getting worse and worse every year. That's what happens when you freeze the nominal amount of the aid and your denominator GDP is growing. As a percent, it continues downwards when it's supposed to be going upwards. So I agree that it's important that we find some means to increase that. I have my skepticism about this transactions tax, but I'm certainly open to discussion and look forward to seeing what the IMF comes up with in coming weeks. Thank you.
I was just thinking that if things had been different a year ago, John would be the finance minister, but that's another story. We tried.
Maybe prime minister.
That's right, you never know.
No,
I was just saying what could have been. No, I'm scolding some of your colleagues, particularly the guy at the top. Anyhow, the G20. Look, the governance piece is extremely important. I think I'm glad you reminded me that right now, the way the G20 is constructed and the way the meetings are going ahead, it's actually not as inclusive as the G8 because it's not structured according to the way the G8 is. So the first thing is to structure the G20 such that there is opportunity for people to have input. And I think it needs to go beyond that. I think, you know, the point, for instance, around South Africa representing all of Africa is obviously it's not sustainable and it's not representative. And I think there has been, it's been very difficult, but I think of some of the issues I've dealt with as a foreign affairs critic around the African Union. Something along those lines where you actually will have a way in which there can be representation through member states to the G20. I think there's probably a lot of support for the G20, but I think John's point is that let's start with that and get it working before we expand the club. But within the club, let's make sure we're hearing from other voices for reasons aforementioned. And if we don't do that, then people would say, why'd you bother with the G20? And that would be credible. You know, the BRIC phenom, I think, is interesting to watch. There has been there was, I believe, during that BRIC conference, some ideas around whether or not they would stick with the American dollar as the basis for measurement and trade. And I believe it was China who nixed that. Which is interesting because China's so implicated in the American economy now. And someone said that the Chinese wouldn't have to roll in the tanks to take over the U.S., they'd just call in the loans, and they would be able to defeat them much easier. But the point being is that when you look at the ways in which capital markets have changed, the fact that the trajectory of the BRIC countries and their growth rates and their largesse, that, you know, the G20 is going to be a structure that if we don't get it right, we're going to be left behind as a country, frankly, because of the way these other, the BRIC countries are really exploding right now. And I think, you know, we would be well suited to not just look at governance because it's a benevolent thing to do, but it's in our self-interest to make sure that the governance is equitable. So clearly, at least a minimum of a structure that was similar to the G8, and obviously consider other ways to make sure that the other disparate voices are heard. There's just two other quick things. The FTT, as our caucus is just finishing our deliberations, it's looking like we will, but I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. We will be approving something in that, within that kind of spirit. Stay tuned on that. And finally, if you look at plugging the leaks and tax havens, I said it in my overview, but if you're going to, you know, recently what we've seen is that some countries go after this when they're desperate. I think Greece is an example, right? All of a sudden they're seized with, well, let's go find all those, you know, the leaks that were, well, you know, it's kind of late for Greece right now to be doing that. The point is that you shouldn't wait till the collapse of your economy to go looking for leaks of capital. And I think that should be not just Greece, it should be all of our economies. And if you do it in a coordinated way, it'll be more effective because we know how leaks happen. It's when people look the other way, there is loopholes created either by design or because of lack of vigilance. And the way to deal with that is a coordinated approach. So, you know, if there are benefits from an FTT to deal with leakages or at least train the attention, the focus to where's the money going and what's happening in our capital markets, then all the better. I believe that's the case, is that when you look at something like an FTT, it's going to focus and look at where is the money going, not just in terms of the transactions, but the leakages as well. So I think it's something that I'm glad to get behind. I think it's something I mentioned in my comments, that this kind of reverse flow of capital going from the south to the north is something we need to acknowledge, but most importantly, we need to do something about it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dewar. I would like to abuse my position as a moderator to lay out a few questions, one for each one of the presenters, and then open the floor for more questions, and maybe you can take them very briefly. My first question would be, well then, to Mr. Baker. Looking at Washington from Ottawa, I was wondering how much these discussions on FTT could be in the American discussion, be a sort of a, and I'm asking you to think in more political ways, not only as an economist, how much of these discussions about FTT will be eventually a potential replacement for more discussions and more through discussions on what the real regulation of the financial system should be in the U.S., which, you know, for good or worse, is going to have an enormous effect on the rest of the world. And also, to what extent it could be a sort of a potential replacement to real punishment for those who have been guilty for this crisis. And otherwise, we end up with a situation in which those who are responsible are, as it was said earlier, being bailed out, to be short. So, to Mr. McCollum, I understand the logic of your argument that an FTT would maybe not be that good to the Canadian economy, or it wouldn't add much benefit to the current regulation of our banking system. My question would be maybe to reverse the logic of your argument. Would it make us so much worse? And I am thinking because actually 2009, unlike what has been said so far, was a terrible year for the Canadian economy. It was maybe not that bad year for the Canadian banking system, but for most Canadians, it was a horrible year. And it was that way because we were influenced by a foreign crisis. and actually we cannot move Canada. So wouldn't it make a certain amount of sense to follow other discussions that are happening beyond our borders, just because they're happening beyond our borders and we are pretty much part of the global economy? To Mr. Pelle, I had the question that is related to other things that were triggered by your reflections. I was very interested in your discussion on the difference between panic and you said anger, if I understood correctly, and sort of sense of normality. You know, the banking sector not only has a huge leverage on politics, as you probably understand well, not only because of its size, but also because of its social role. I mean, we tend to believe that now we have a constitutional right to a credit card, and we also tend to believe that we have a constitutional right to a very good pension, right? And we have an aging society, and I understand that has been the problem, and you, for your experience in the Cache de Quebec, must know this very well, that puts a huge amount of pressure on financial institutions to provide increasing levels of revenue. And that makes them eventually more and more reckless. And at the same time, they are dealing, particularly in public banking, with having to take increasing levels of government debt, yeah? Because the governments are increasingly in debt. So I was wondering how you could think whether the FTT would actually be perhaps in the way of the banking system and the financial system in a way fulfilling part of that social contract that we have today in Canada and other places. And to Mr. Dewar, my question has to do with your reflection on Minister Flaherty. He said, as you very correctly summarized, that, well, whatever the U.S. may do, it has to do with because of its own problems. We haven't had those problems, therefore we shouldn't apply the same solution. And I wanted to recall your memory. One of the colleagues of Minister Flaherty, the one in charge on the environment, I cannot remember, and in charge of industry, was saying the exact opposite about climate change. That because the Americans are going to do X, Y, and Z, then we should do X, Y, and Z, not anything different and not anything before. So we are integrated with the U.S. economy in energy, but we are somehow not integrated with the U.S. economy in finance. I was wondering what your take would be on that dichotomy, and if you would be ready to also take the climate change side of the equation. So now if maybe we can take a few more questions and then we have our presenters respond. You can rest assured you'll be anonymous. Yeah. Bill Martin.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I have to be somewhere at 7 o'clock.
Yeah. Okay. 1 minute.
Why don't you just answer those questions then?
Yeah. Okay. I'll answer the question since you asked me first. why not? What harm would a transaction tax do, and what shouldn't we be open to? Yeah, as Paul Dewar said, and I fully agree, and as I said, especially as chair of this G20 G8 meeting, of course we should entertain it. We shouldn't just reject it out of hand. And you asked me whether it would have done Canada any harm. I'm not sure. I'm not convinced, apart from the money, which is a big apart from, but apart from the money, whether it would do the world any good. Because I'm not convinced that it had anything to do, that financial transactions had anything to do with the bubbles of either the housing market or the high tech or the subprime mortgages or other things that caused the recent crisis. The link between that and this transactions tax strikes me as non-existent. So maybe it wouldn't do any harm to Canada, but I'm not convinced it would do any good for the world. But I'm not opposed to studying it. I might be wrong, but I haven't heard arguments linking that tax with desirable outcomes for the global or the Canadian economy.
I understand Mr. Pellier has to leave very soon, so if you don't mind.
No, it's fine.
C'est la job de parlementaire que d'être à plusieurs places en même temps. Et donc, effectivement, en tout cas, je suis comme John, on va peut-être se retrouver, je ne sais pas. Il y a une différence entre la panique et la colère. La panique, c'est une réaction. La colère, c'est un sentiment. Et les gens qui sont paniqués n'ont plus le temps d'être en colère. Ils sont paniqués. Et on peut être en colère et être méfiant, être inquiet, mais de continuer à être obligé que de faire confiance. Il y a une des choses, cependant, pour honorer les contrats sociaux, je pense qu'au Canada, les institutions financières ont tout de même un bon degré de confiance par rapport à la clientèle ou aux pensionnés. Les pensionnés, ils vont recevoir leur pension pas à cause des promesses des banques, mais à cause des promesses faites par leur employeur. Et il faut que les employeurs tiennent debout. Il faut que les fiduciaires soient toujours debout. Il faut que les gestionnaires de portefeuille soient toujours là. Là-dessus, il faut faire attention de ne pas mélanger. Les banques ne sont pas responsables de tout et une chance, que ce soit positif et négatif. Il y a un élément, cependant, dans tout ce que vous avez dit qui doit être bien analysé, c'est que quand on reçoit les baby boomers vont prendre de retraite où ils le sont déjà, ils reçoivent du salaire différé par leurs entreprises au moment de leur pension. Ça, c'est une chose. Au niveau du secteur public, tous les fonctionnaires, tous les gens qui travaillent dans le secteur public, là, les gens ont l'impression que là, ce n'est pas du salaire déféré, ce n'est pas de l'investissement pour plus tard, c'est les taxes des individus. Et ça, la compréhension au Québec, je dirais, elle est différente de la compréhension au Canada, parce que bon nombre des systèmes de pension au Québec étaient déjà fully funded depuis les années 60.
The point that you made about Jim Prentice as environment minister saying, hey, we can't do anything on the environment because we have to wait for the Americans after you, Alphonse. We would never have had an acid rain treaty if that was the case. And the lakes and the forests around here would be dead. We took leadership then. We need to take leadership on these issues for the interests of our country and for our global leadership. But, you know, I thought the same when I was listening to Flaherty, who was kind of, you know, suggesting that this isn't something, you know, he was like he was an Albanian or something. We don't have to worry about anything. We'll just fine here the way things are. You don't have to engage with the world. And I think that needs to be put on the table. I just want to say to my friend John on the FTT, my understanding, I might be corrected here, but I don't think it's to implicate as much as you think. And I think one of the things that we saw during the lead up to the financial crisis, because you remember a year before, everyone's saying this baby's going to blow, right? When they were looking at the subprime, and we looked at other, derivatives. Explain that, please, anyone. I mean, the people who are in these houses, financial houses, who are engaged in this business, can't explain it. So clearly, if we're looking at, you know, specious kinds of investment, one way of regulating and disciplining is to look at the transactions and to put some guidance on it. And one of the ways to do that, as we know in government, is to put a tax on it. And I think that you're right, though, it needs to be understood perhaps better, but that's what I think we're here to do, and hopefully that's what the opportunity of the G8 and G20 is. But my understanding wasn't to implicate as much as, you know, might be suggested every time, you know, you cross the border or mortgages for that matter. I think it was to look at, and you refine the tool as best you wish, but my understanding was not to implicate as much as that. Thank you.
I'll just say a couple things. Just in terms of structure of the tax, obviously a lot would be up for grabs in terms of how you do this, but just as a purely practical matter, if you look at the rates that have been tossed out there, say the rates that have been proposed on foreign exchange, you're talking around somewhere around 1 or 2/100ths of 1%. Maybe someone is pushing a higher one, but that's the rates I've been hearing. I don't think any of us would notice that. So, you know, those of us taking a trip across the border, not coming up here, if you come to the United States, you will not notice whether or not we have that tax. So we can make a great effort to make sure you don't pay it, but frankly, it's going to be so invisible. If you go to the exchange at the airport, they're going to charge you a 30 or 40 basis point premium. So you're talking about raising that, you know, by 5%. You will not notice that. I'll guarantee that. So we could put a lot of effort to make sure you pay zero, but I really don't care. Maybe your politicians do, but, you know, you won't notice, you won't care. So that's why, I mean, that's part of the, to my mind, virtue of the tax, is that almost by definition, it will have very, very little effect on the vast majority of transactions that normal people take. We could try to exclude them, or you could say, go ahead and pay it. You won't notice that. The other point, in terms of how the response, and this is a point I usually make, and for whatever reason I forgot when I was originally talking about, we've had a huge decline in trading costs over the last three decades. That's been because of the development of computer technology. So the cost of doing most of these transactions has fallen, in many cases, 70, 80, 90%. So if we double that cost, we're getting back to where we were in 1990, 1985. So we don't have to sit here and worry, oh, my God, we don't know what the world would look like. It wasn't long ago we were in that world. So it's not like, you know, the markets are just going to grind to a halt. I mean, so, I should have been clear on that, but it's just silly. That simply can't happen. We will reduce the volume. We have rough estimates. We'll be 50%, 60%, 70%. It'll vary depending on the rates, the market, but it's not going to go to zero. We know that. Now, I'm sorry, getting to the question that I was asked, where this stands the United States, we have a situation where the country is very, very angry at the financial industry. People are suffering enormously. We have close to 10% unemployment. And, you know, the United States, unlike, say, Canada, somewhere in the middle here, but, you know, a country like Germany or France has a relatively generous social welfare state. The United States does not. It's, you know, it's organized around the idea you work. You could argue whether that's good or bad, but the point is it's not organized around supporting people who are unemployed for long periods of time. And that's what we're faced with right now. And that means you have a lot of people, not just poor people who might be used to it. They aren't happy about being poor, but they're used to not having a lot. You have a lot of middle-income people who are facing unemployment for long periods of time. They're very, very angry. And they take that out on Wall Street. Now, at the same time, the politicians of both parties look to Wall Street for support. And it's not a secret. President Obama, when he ran for president, many of the members of Congress, Democratic members of Congress, have received generous support from the financial industry. So that makes it very hard to move a financial transactions tax in the United States. Now, at the same time, it is being seriously discussed. So you get people like the Speaker of our House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, said this is something that's on the table. So, you know, where does this go? You know, if you'd offer me a bet on it, I wouldn't take it even money, at least not that would pass this year, probably not next year. But it is certainly something that's being discussed seriously. And depending on the course of the economy, it may well be something that does get through. So, you know, if we're having this discussion 2 years ago and said financial transactions tax, most people, when I'm saying these people involved in political debates, would look at you like you're speaking something loony. It is taken seriously today.
Thank you. Please.
Did you want to go ahead?
I wanted to thank Dean Baker for coming up here. I think he presented a really good explanation of where we are and the arguments for financial tax, transactions tax, or some other tax. And I want to apologize as a Canadian for the actions of our government in obstructing this. And I think that we, to a certain extent, we all bear some sort of collective responsibility for not holding either the government or the financial sector to task. I just want to, and unfortunately, both the Liberal and the Bloc Québécois, it's great that they came here, but it's unfortunate that they've left. There have been editorials in two of the largest Canadian papers praising Flaherty for his position on this, but they really miss the point in a lot of ways. I mean, there are three points there. There's one there are a few different points for financial transactions tax. One is to pay for the cost of the crisis. And there's a bit of a collective amnesia that Canadians did not suffer cost from this crisis, or that there was no money going to the financial industry. It combined deficits will amount to $100 billion in Canada. Of course. The second one is the whole issue of insurance. And there's been there's this real canard out there about moral hazard, as if there's no moral hazard out there. I mean, limited liability of companies and the ways that directors and executives are compensated is a major moral hazard or asymmetric risk relationship that exists already. And Flaherty's proposal of contingent capital is something that would probably increase the volatility of stocks in any case. I don't know if you're aware of what he's proposed on that, Dean. The third thing is that I think a lot of people have missed the point that that the purpose of it is to try and prevent the economic crises from happening. I mean, Dean put it very well, that there was an economic crisis or stagnation that underlined the financial crisis. A lot of people in Canada think that it was that the financial and economic crisis was something that was completely external. But we had completely stagnant productivity, and this even worse than the United States, stagnant real wages, and a bloated financial sector as well. Sorry, I should lead to some questions here. I suppose that's part of the point here. But I guess some questions need to, and I assume that a lot of people here are supportive of either financial transaction tax or heavier tax on the financial industry. I guess one of my questions, if others have been in the room, is the financial sector considered undertaxed? And then secondly, because in Canada, as in many other countries, financial transactions are not taxed, like unlike a lot of other transactions. Secondly, what do you see as the greatest potential for further movement on this? It was a good coalition of environmental and development groups who saw the FDT as an opportunity for further progress on that. That kind of obscured some of the economic arguments for it to a certain extent. But are there opportunities for greater progress in this area by pushing on either FAT or other types of taxes as opposed to a financial transactions tax?
Well, I'll just take first shot quickly. Dealing with a couple of things. Again, one of the points I should have made more clearly, I think, in terms of the relationship of possible impact of the transactions tax on a crisis. Again, I think you got my point. I would not say that this tax, had it been in place, would have prevented the crisis, but I do think the crisis is the result of sort of a bad growth path. So it's striking to me that, again, I'm U.S. focused, but I think you just tell a similar story for Canada and really much of the rest of the world, that developed world, that from the end of World War II up through the 70s, you had good, robust growth, broadly shared income growth, good productivity growth, and then you get this pattern where that's no longer true. And again, that's, I think, more pronounced in the U.S. than Canada, but a general slowdown in productivity growth, rates of growth of investment, and again, more pronounced in the U.S., but greater inequality. So I think those do go together. Would a financial transaction tax prevent that? Absolutely not, not in and of itself. But I think the crisis came out of a situation where we did have bubbles. And that is a very important thing to emphasize, that I argue with people in the United States about this all the time, because they focus on the financial crisis and I go, that's true, we had that, but had we not had the housing bubble, that really wouldn't have mattered. I mean, it was because you had the housing bubble that you had this whole dynamic, and that was what led to trillions of dollars of wealth being destroyed, and that's why we had so much unemployment. Because at the end of the day, I couldn't care less that, Ben Bernanke spending the weekend up figuring out how to rescue Lehman. What we care about is its impact on the real economy, and the reason why that was so large was because you had this huge housing bubble. In terms of, is the financial sector undertaxed? I think, my argument, of course, it obviously is, but I was really pleased to see that the IMF in that study, they made that point because, you know, exactly as you say, it's exempted from a lot of taxes. And I think, you know, you'd have to look at it case by case, but I think there's sort of this idea somehow, you know, finance is the sort of thing you don't really want to tax. So, you know, certainly it's exempted from value-added taxes in most countries that have them. In the U.S., where we have state sales taxes in most states, it's exempted. And there's not a good argument for that, at least not that I can see. So, you know, something like a financial transactions tax or the FAT tax, I mean, that's, to my mind, just beginning of leveling the playing field. Let's tax this like we do anything else. So there was a good recognition of that. The last point I'll just make is that there is, you know, I was making the case, and it seems sort of evidently true, but there's actually now some very good research that looks at the evidence that you're seeing large rents in the financial sector, the rents being that people are making much more money because they're working shuffling paper on Wall Street than they'd be making, you know, at working as engineers or other, you know, highly skilled trades. And there's a very good paper done by Larry Katz, who's one of the leading labor economists, Larry Katz and Claudia Golden, who are very good labor economists in the United States, where they're both at Harvard. They took advantage of that. They got students' grades, their scores, and they compared how the people did who went to Wall Street with people who had the same grades and scores who went to work in, you know, biotech or, you know, Silicon Valley or wherever else we might think they're doing productive work. And there were huge premiums for the people who went to work on Wall Street, which tells you something because, you know, just as an economist, we think people respond to incentives, you know, at least to some extent. So what does that mean? Instead of having people go work on developing cures for diseases or better technologies, clean technologies, they're going to make lots of money working for Goldman Sachs. And to my mind, that's a really big problem and a good argument for a tax.
Maybe we can take one more question or two more. Or maybe we can just share the snacks in the back and have a friendly chat. Thank you very much to all, and thank you very much to the Halifax Initiative. Yeah.